Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is imperative that we keep our eye in that war on its East Asian front, and nobody does a better job of that than our first guest, in fact, a weekly contributor to our program, Gordon Chang. He is a columnist for the Daily Beast. He is widely seen on Fox News and elsewhere. He is the author of two best-selling books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. This is, of course, a topic that both of these that are very much front and center in our conversations with him. We're always delighted to have him with us. Gordon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, apropos the nuclear showdown business, there is a report, I believe it's out of the Eurasian Review, that U.S. intelligence has concluded that sometime earlier this fall, North Korea did what many of us have believed they were perfectly capable of doing, namely selling three atomic or perhaps even thermonuclear weapons to Iran, a country with whom the regime in Pyongyang has been joined at the hip, both with respect to nuclear weapons technology and ballistic missile programs. Gordon, do you credit this report? And if so, what are the implications?
It's possibly true. This report mentions that North Korea sold these nukes, and they were transferred to Iran through both Russian and Chinese airspace. We know that the North Koreans have sold a lot of ballistic missiles to the Iranians, also have given them nuclear weapons technology. So, for instance, the Iranians have been on site for at least the first five of North Korea's six detonations. They could very well have been there at the sixth, but we don't have information on that yet, because that was just September 3. And the Iranians paid the North Koreans somewhere between $2.5 to $3 billion a year for their various forms of cooperation. Now, whether this story is true or not, of course, we don't know. But the one thing that I think is important for the American people is that we hear from the administration what they know, because this affects so many things. It changes all the narratives about China and Russia and solving the North Korean crisis. So there needs to be a complete airing of this. And this is one time where I think that the administration needs to talk to not only American public, but publics around the world about North Korea's proliferation.
Yeah, this comes, of course, at a moment when there's an increasing concern about Iran anyway, whether it is simply developing its own nuclear capabilities, as you say, perhaps with North Korean help, or for that matter, Russian, Chinese, Pakistani, who knows. But to actually see what, again, many of us have been warning about for some time, this perhaps leapfrogging from what it would take for the Iranians to acquire nuclear weapons the old-fashioned way, that is to say, building their own, versus simply acquiring them from somebody who's prepared to sell them ones that are good to go, as they say, is really a very alarming development, if it's true. And I think you're right, we do need to hear from the administration as to whether that is the case or not. Gordon, do you think, knowing a lot about the world, and in particular about the appetite for countries around it for nuclear weapons capabilities, now that it seems both the North Koreans and the Iranians are, if not already fully equipped with them, shortly to be, that the North may find it has a cash crop that it can sell to a lot of other comers as well?
Yeah, the North Koreans have sold just about everything that is in their inventory, so we shouldn't be surprised that they would sell their most destructive implements. And we know that the North Koreans have exported nuclear weapons technology to the Iranians. And so, for instance, just going back to the Israeli raid on that Syrian reactor was North Korean design. There are reports which are credible that North Koreans were actually killed in that raid. And it's pretty clear that the regime of Bashar al-Assad did not pay for that reactor because he just didn't have the cash. It's pretty clear in my mind that the Iranians paid for that reactor and that this was the Iranian nuclear weapons program, not within Iran's borders, but really outsourced to a neighbor. And we're seeing this in a different way play out with North Korea, because we know that both Tehran and Pyongyang signed a technical cooperation agreement in September 2012. There are reports, just rumors, but could very well be true, that Iranians were based at a North Korean military base just south of the Chinese border. These are questions that we need to have answers to, because it has so many implications, not only for the Iranian Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, what we call the nuclear deal, but also the North Korean threat, because this is not just North Korea. This is North Korea exporting its most dangerous weapons around the world.
Yeah. Gordon, you've recently written at the Daily Beast about the effort that has been underway for a long time, of course, to try to persuade the North Koreans to give up their nuclear weapons ambitions. A fool's errand, I think it's fair to say, by any reasonable measure to this point. The Russians have seemingly gotten into the act now. There's reason to believe, as I think we'll be talking about with Matt shortly, that they intend to insert themselves into the Middle East peace process too. But talk about some of the activities that the Putin regime has been engaged in with respect to North Korea and how it might be making for a more dangerous crisis there rather than attenuating it.
The Russians are doing two things. First of all, they're backfilling, as our ambassador Nikki Haley has said. In other words, as the Chinese are reducing their economic support for Pyongyang, the Russians are increasing it. So, for instance, they're stepping up their supplies of oil, which is critically important for the regime in Pyongyang. Also, they supplied a second internet link for North Korea. That started operating on October 1st. That gives the North Koreans even more capability of launching cyber attacks against the world. And the other thing that the Russians are doing is helping the North Koreans on an important goal, and that is to try to start negotiations so that the world will support the North Korean regime. So at this particular time, it just seems that Russia is troublemaking. They say they want peace, but what they're really doing is they are helping the North Koreans achieve some diplomatic goals.
Certainly getting out of its isolation, that's for sure. And Gordon Chang, just on that point you've just made about helping the North Koreans gain access to additional means by which to wage cyber attacks against, among others, this country, it has to be seen as a most unfriendly act by the Russians, is it not?
Absolutely. And what the United States should be doing is declaring to both Beijing and Moscow that we will take any North Korean cyber attack as a cyber attack from the Chinese and the Russians. We know that North Korean cyber warriors, for instance, are based on Chinese soil. A few of them are based on Russian soil. And yet we allow this situation to continue. So, for instance, the attacks against Sony Pictures Entertainment in 2014, those were launched from Chinese IP addresses. The Chinese had to know what was going on because of their great firewall, their sophisticated control system. So they knew about the cyber attacks going out from North Korea, from China, as well as all the data that had been exfiltrated from Sony. Hundreds of terabytes of it was going into China. And yet we did not hold the Chinese accountable for that. So that is our fault.
It is our fault, and it may well set a precedent, if we're not careful here, as to how we will behave if, in effect, a Russian channel becomes used for the same kind of purpose. I assume you would anticipate that if that were the case, the Russians would be fully cognizant, as the Chinese doubtless were in this earlier incident, is it not?
Yes, and so we have yet to come to grips with a very unpleasant reality that North Korea is just the paw for both Moscow and Beijing. And it's not just cyber attacks, of course. You know, the Chinese have been supporting the North Korean ballistic missile program, its nuclear weapons effort. They've been weaponizing North Korea. So our policy just does not acknowledge that. And so there are so many of these facts that the American administrations have yet to deal with.
And come to grips with, needless to say. Gordon Chang, thank you. We have to leave it at that for the moment. There's so much more to talk with you about. We'll look forward to doing so next week. Thank you for your time today and for the great work you do at The Daily Beast, Fox News, and elsewhere. Matt Brodsky joins us next. As promised, we'll talk about the possibility of Iranian nukes at hand and the embassy relocation and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined, I'm pleased to say, by Matt Brodsky. He is these days a senior fellow at the Security Studies Group. He is also a Middle East analyst at Wikistrat and a longtime contributor in myriad capacities to the public policy debate on the Middle East, most especially his area of expertise. It's always a delight to have him with us, and I want to say welcome back, Matt. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So, Matt, I was talking in the earlier segment about a report, as yet unconfirmed, that U.S. intelligence believes there have been 3 nuclear weapons and a dirty bomb to boot sold to the Iranians by the North Koreans. I don't know whether you credit that report or not, or even if you've seen it, but I wonder what your thoughts would be about the possibility that the activities we're all quite familiar with, that the Iranians and North Koreans have engaged in jointly, have perhaps taken this turn.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. Again, we know that there's been an access of really proliferation in the Middle East between North Korea and Syria and Iran. We know that Israel actually, in one of its latest strikes inside Syria, of the 2 that occurred in 4 days, the latter one occurred for the Syrian research site, which is actually what is in charge of the chemical weapons program in Syria. And that had actually been working with North Korea since the 90s. They helped fit Scud missiles to carry these type of weapons. So we already know that North Korea and Iran have been working closely together. We know that advances that Iran makes or North Korea makes, they'll share with each other. We know that there's a nexus with Syria. And so this type of information would be in line with what bad case scenarios are. And unfortunately, on the ground at the same time, it's moving in the direction where Iran is gaining more territory.
On that point about the Iranians' activities on the ground, there's been increasing evidence that they are now filling the vacuum that has been created by the liberation of the areas that the Islamic State once held, and generally speaking, the opportunity to work with the Russians and their Syrian allies to essentially consolidate a post-conflict domination of Syria. Is that how you see it?
They absolutely are. Between them, their greatest crown jewel, Hezbollah, expanding territory. Many of their militias who are active in Iraq, they are also pledging their loyalty, not just to Iran, but to Assad, should he decide that he wants to attack Israel. So from the Israeli perspective, they're watching this slow motion train wreck where the South Lebanon model is being transferred to southern Syria. And of course, to back this up a second, when the United States fears going to war with North Korea, the first thing that is cited typically is the vast array of artillery power in the south of North Korea that would strike Seoul. Well, they're watching this develop slow motion in Syria, except they are pledged not to allow that to happen. But between Iranian bases being developed, there's a game of a new red lines being established, new rules of engagement, if you will, between Israel and Hezbollah or Iran. There was a different set of rules that existed during the Syrian civil war, and a new one is in the midst of being established. And so far, the message Israel has sent is, we won't allow any Iranian bases in Syria. That might be too much, because that's a fact at this point. But we'll see how that shakes out.
We're using a term sort of loosely here. I'm not sure slow motion actually describes what's happening, Matt Brodsky. It seems as though it's galloping along, really. And I guess what I hear you saying is that the Israeli red lines are now basically trying to keep the Golan Heights out of artillery range. Is that essentially what's happening? And isn't that really a function of how much capacity the Iranians put on the ground, whether those are, 25 kilometers away from the Golan Heights, or whether it turns out that their batteries can actually reach 30 kilometers or more?
See, that's exactly it. And that, I mean, these are the type of answers that, of course, they're not giving out publicly, and that I am trying to get, because, I mean, that's the point. When the base that they struck, Al-Kiswa, is 8 miles south of Damascus, it's 30 miles away from the Golan Heights and that Israeli border. It's a matter of the distance that can be reached. So again, when I said that, that Israel, Netanyahu has said that he doesn't want to see any Iranian long-term presence in Iran. Okay, that's, I think, probably too ambitious, just because the fact is Assad can't remain in power without Iranian forces. His own forces are far too weak, and it would just lead to the continuation of the civil war. So it's a matter of, okay, well, then where is the red line for Israel? Where do they have to be pushed back to? And if they have the type of weapons that reports are indicating, that's a far more scarier prospect as far as anything related to a nuclear capability. But yes, how far back? Is it just from Damascus, which is, that's fairly close to the Golan Heights, or is it further back? We know before, red lines for what they could strike in Syria was essentially Homs and anything south.
And what we know of the Iranian order of battle is that it is mobile, and it can be moved fairly quickly to more forward positions, which could really, I guess what I hear you saying, Matt Brodsky, is something I've been increasingly concerned about, too. This is a tinderbox and could well result in a major regional conflict, if not one that actually extends beyond there. Hey, let me turn to another topic that is on both of our minds, I'm sure. President Trump, of course, last week announced that he was recognizing reality, that Jerusalem is, in fact, Israel's capital, and that the United States Embassy will be moved rather more slowly than I think is in order, but nonetheless moved to Jerusalem. There have been a lot of demonstrations and protests and demarches and denunciations of him for doing this. What are your thoughts on both the advisability of it and what comes next?
I think this is a long overdue correction in U.S. policy that has in fact favored Palestinian claims to Jerusalem. I don't think many people are aware of that our policy of neutrality after Israel's establishment in 1949, we had said that we would just let negotiations deal with that and we won't have anything to do with the Jerusalem final status issue. So when we put the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv, when the Oslo peace process began in the 90s, we maintained a U.S. consulate in Jerusalem, but it dealt only with Palestinians. So that's actually been showing favoritism on the city to the Palestinians. So this actually writes a policy historic wrong that the United States has had. And of course, it's just the same thing as recognizing the world is round. It's a fact. And I think it also helps push back on Palestinian mythology, which has prevented them from making any type of compromise in peace negotiations. Because the fact is, Israel is never going to relinquish its capital. No nation on earth would relinquish its own capital. To believe that they would is to simply just throw something into the gears of any future type of peace process. And there's a lot of other mythology that Palestinians still need to deal with, and it would behoove the international community to look at it that way, instead of going onto the streets to promote this ongoing fiction that keeps the situation as it is.
Well said, Matt Brodsky, and thank you for doing it on our program. It's always good to have you with us. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, keep up your good work elsewhere, and thank you for joining us. Next up, Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation joins us. We'll talk about DACA, Guam, and judges. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Hans von Spakovsky. He is one of the great utility infielders at the Heritage Foundation. He works there as a senior legal fellow in the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. But he brings to bear a wealth of experience in government, both in the executive branch and in the Federal Election Commission, on which he served for 2 years as a member. He has also been in the senior ranks of the Justice Department. He has been very prolific in his commentaries and analyses in various publications, periodical as well as book length, including one he co-authored with John Fund, Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. Hans, let me welcome you. Thanks so much for joining us. Good to have you back.
Well, thanks for having me back.
You have been talking for some time about what's going on with respect to this so-called DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Republicans seem to be now mustering out to try to ensure that Democrats get their way on this. What is going on, and what should be? What are the myths that are associated with this program?
Well, first of all, they shouldn't be talking about another amnesty, because that will simply attract even more illegal aliens. Remember, that's what happened after the 1986 amnesty deal that Ronald Reagan agreed to his great regret later. That caused even more aliens to come in thinking, well, if the government did it once, they'll do it again, and we better get there, so we'll be ready for it.
As long as there's not a secure border that allows them to come in at will, right?
Yeah, no, exactly right. And right now, Congress ought to be concentrating on exactly that, securing the border and enforcing immigration laws to reduce the number of illegals already in the country, not providing another amnesty deal. But look, the biggest myth about DACA is basically this. This is projected as something for people who were 2 or 3 years old when they came to the U.S. from places like Mexico, who don't speak the native languages of their home countries, and it'd be a hardship to send them back.
And they're all very gainfully employed and working hard and a real asset to our society. Yep.
Exactly right. But if you actually look at the demographics of the currently about 690,000 individuals, illegal aliens who were DACA beneficiaries, you find that all falls apart. First of all, many of them were teenagers when they came here, because you qualified as long as you got here before your 16th birthday. Now, Frank, you and I both know a teenager, by the time he's 16, he's had 10 years of schooling in their home country. They're obviously fluent in their native language, inculcated in the culture of that language. So the idea that suddenly, you know, sending them back to be a problem is just not true. Also, there was no requirement of the DACA program for English fluency. And I found at least one estimate that probably as much as 25% of the DACA beneficiaries are functionally illiterate in English, and another up to 50% only have a basic English ability. Also, apparently only 49% of DACA beneficiaries have a high school education. And by the way, you know, if you served in the military, you could also qualify. How many folks do you think actually served in the military out of that 690,000? Only 900. So what you're talking about here is a population that is large portions are barely literate in English. They come from a low education, low skilled background, and providing them with amnesty is going to be a huge cost to the American taxpayer, because of all of the government benefits they're suddenly going to be eligible for.
So let me ask you, Hans, why is the Democratic Party pressing so hard to get this amnesty? I suppose that's fairly self-evident given their general attitude on open borders. But what I don't understand is, why are Republicans now, some 34 or 5 of them in the House most recently, signing onto a letter insisting that this has to be resolved before the end of the year, some in the Senate doing the same?
I think they're afraid of looking like they, you know, like they don't have a heart, because that's what the other side pushes. Why, you must be cold. You must have a cold heart, be without mercy, to want to send these poor kids back. But again, that's based on the mythical view of these DACA beneficiaries. Look, I don't doubt there are, you know, some small number of people who only came here when they were two or three. But again, the actual demographics of it, that's not the way this population looks. And I think they're being pushed into it because politically they're just scared to stand up and say, no, we're not going to do amnesty.
It's a critical point, and I appreciate so much the clarity that you and your colleagues at the Heritage Foundation are bringing to it, and pray that Republicans will see the merit of, at least if they're going to consider doing something like this, doing it in a thoughtful and deliberative way, but most especially after the border has been secured so it doesn't become the magnet, as you say. Let me turn to another topic with you, Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation. One of our colleagues, a good friend and longtime partner of yours, J. Christian Adams, has been working for some time trying to prevent what really seems like a racist election from taking place in the U.S. territory of Guam. The Department of Justice has finally turned up on the right side in this. Tell us what that backstory is and whether this is symptomatic of finally things beginning to change from the Eric Holder type of Justice Department that you've written so critically about.
Sure. Guam decided, you know, Guam is a U.S. territory, also one of our most important naval bases in the Pacific is located there. And they decided they wanted to have a plebiscite on the future of the territory. Did people there want it to remain a territory, to become a state, become independent, et cetera? So they set up a voter registration process for that vote, and they set up one of the most blatantly racist registration systems, like what used to happen, unfortunately, in the Jim Crow South. If you were not what they considered to be a native Chamorro, and the Chamorros were the natives who originally populated the island, you would not be allowed to register. And J. Christian Adams and the Center for Individual Rights were contacted by a retired Air Force officer. He'd been stationed on Guam, decided to retire there and live there as a resident, because when he tried to register, he was not allowed to register. Why? Because he's white. So they filed suit that is obviously both a violation of the Constitution and a violation of the Voting Rights Act to not allow someone to register because of their ancestry, that the Supreme Court has said that's just another way of preventing somebody from registering to vote because of their race. This lawsuit, if you can believe this, Frank, was filed back in 2011. And the Obama administration, under both Loretta Lynch and Eric Holder, the Justice Department, refused to get into the lawsuit and represent this Air Force officer. They refused to help him, even though the territorial government was straight out discriminating against him. They finally won it at the district court or trial level in Guam. The territory of Guam appealed the decision to the Ninth Circuit this year. And now, finally, after 8 years of ignoring the case, the U.S. Justice Department has come in on the side of Mr. Davis, the retired Air Force officer. Very clear that only happened because the Trump administration took over and said, well, we're going to do what's right in this case.
I'm delighted that Jeff Sessions' Justice Department is doing that. It's facing a lot of criticism on other fronts. And I guess I would just ask you, in particular, Hans von Spakovsky, how the Trump administration is doing on the issue of judges and sort of the Justice Department's performance more broadly.
Well, you know, they have probably nominated some of the best individuals to ever be nominated for the federal courts. And so far, he's gotten a fair number of them confirmed, even though the Democrats are forcing what are called cloture votes on every single one. That has never happened in the entire history of the United States. In other words, the Democrats are doing everything they can to delay these people getting in. But the choices they're making are very good. They're all conservative constitutionalists, people who believe in applying the Constitution and the law as written, not as some liberal judge would imagine they think it ought to be. So that they're very good. At the Justice Department, the problem there is the swamp, as we call it. There are still so many people there who were hired during the Obama administration. You know, there are holdovers. There are political people who were put into career slots. You know, that's not supposed to happen, but it did. And so they have, frankly, all this internal opposition that's making it hard for them to get things done.
Yeah, it is indeed. we have to leave it at that. Hans, I want to get you back on soon to talk about election fraud. It seems as though there is election fraud after all, at least when it impinges upon Democrats' election prospects. But that's for another day. Thank you so much for visiting with us at this point on these very important issues, Hans, and for the great work you do at the Heritage Foundation and also on the President's Commission on Election Reform. We'll talk with you again soon, my friend. In the meantime, stay well. Come back to us soon. Russ Dallin is next. We'll get the latest on Venezuela and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Hans von Spakovsky. He is one of the great utility infielders at the Heritage Foundation. He works there as a senior legal fellow in the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. But he brings to bear a wealth of experience in government, both in the executive branch and in the Federal Election Commission, on which he served for 2 years as a member. He has also been in the senior ranks of the Justice Department. He has been very prolific in his commentaries and analyses in various publications, periodical as well as book length, including one he co-authored with John Fund, Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. Hans, let me welcome you. Thanks so much for joining us. Good to have you back.
Well, thanks for having me back.
You have been talking for some time about what's going on with respect to this so-called DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Republicans seem to be now mustering out to try to ensure that Democrats get their way on this. What is going on and what should be? What are the myths that are associated with this program?
Well, first of all, they shouldn't be talking about another amnesty because that will simply attract even more illegal aliens. Remember, that's what happened after the 1986 amnesty deal that Ronald Reagan agreed to his great regret later. That caused even more aliens to come in thinking, well, if the government did it once, they'll do it again, and we better get there, so we'll be ready for it.
As long as there's not a secure border that allows them to come in at will, right?
Yeah, no, exactly right. And right now, Congress ought to be concentrating on exactly that, securing the border and enforcing immigration laws to reduce the number of illegals already in the country, not providing another amnesty deal. But look, the biggest myth about DACA is basically this. This is projected as something for people who were 2 or 3 years old when they came to the U.S. from places like Mexico, who don't speak the native languages of their home countries, and it'd be a hardship to send them back.
And they're all very gainfully employed and working hard and a real asset to our society. Yep.
Exactly right. But if you actually look at the demographics of the currently about 690,000 individuals, illegal aliens who were DACA beneficiaries, you find that that all falls apart. First of all, many of them were teenagers when they came here because you qualified as long as you got here before your 16th birthday. Now, Frank, you and I both know a teenager, by the time he's 16, he's had 10 years of schooling in their home country. They're obviously fluent in their native language, inculcated in the culture of that language. So the idea that suddenly, you know, sending them back to be a problem is just not true. Also, there was no requirement of the DACA program for English fluency. And I found at least one estimate that probably as much as 25% of the DACA beneficiaries are functionally illiterate in English, and another up to 50% only have a basic English ability. Also, apparently only 49% of DACA beneficiaries have a high school education. And by the way, you know, if you served in the military, you could also qualify. How many folks do you think actually served in the military out of that 690,000? Only 900. So what you're talking about here is a population that is large portions are barely literate in English. They come from a low education, low skilled background, and providing them with amnesty is going to be a huge cost to the American taxpayer because of all of the government benefits they're suddenly going to be eligible for.
So let me ask you, Hans, why is the Democratic Party pressing so hard to get this amnesty? I suppose that's fairly self-evident given their general attitude on open borders. But what I don't understand is why are Republicans now, some 34 or 5 of them in the House most recently, signing onto a letter insisting that this has to be resolved before the end of the year, some in the Senate doing the same?
I think they're afraid of looking like they, you know, like they don't have a heart, because that's what the other side pushes. Why, you must be cold. You must have a cold heart, be without mercy to want to send these poor kids back. But again, that's based on the mythical view of these DACA beneficiaries. Look, I don't doubt there are, you know, some small number of people who only came here when they were 2 or 3. But again, the actual demographics of it, that's not the way this population looks. And I think they're being pushed into it because politically they're just scared to stand up and say, no, we're not going to do amnesty.
It's a critical point, and I appreciate so much the clarity that you and your colleagues at the Heritage Foundation are bringing to it, and pray that Republicans will see the merit of, at least if they're going to consider doing something like this, doing it in a thoughtful and deliberative way, but most especially after the border has been secured so it doesn't become the magnet, as you say. Let me turn to another topic with you, Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation. One of our colleagues, a good friend and longtime partner of yours, J. Christian Adams, has been working for some time trying to prevent what really seems like a racist election from taking place in the U.S. territory of Guam. The Department of Justice has finally turned up on the right side in this. Tell us what that backstory is and whether this is symptomatic of finally things beginning to change from the Eric Holder type of Justice Department that you've written so critically about.
Sure. Guam decided, you know, Guam is a U.S. territory, also one of our most important naval bases in the Pacific is located there. And they decided they wanted to have a plebiscite on the future of the territory. Did people there want it to remain a territory, to become a state, become independent, et cetera? So they set up a voter registration process for that vote, and they set up one of the most blatantly racist registration systems, like what used to happen, unfortunately, in the Jim Crow South. If you were not what they considered to be a native Chamorro, and the Chamorros were the natives who originally populated the island, you would not be allowed to register. And J. Christian Adams and the Center for Individual Rights were contacted by a retired Air Force officer. He'd been stationed on Guam, decided to retire there and live there as a resident, because when he tried to register, he was not allowed to register. Why? Because he's white. So they filed suit that is obviously both a violation of the Constitution and a violation of the Voting Rights Act to not allow someone to register because of their ancestry, that the Supreme Court has said that's just another way of preventing somebody from registering to vote because of their race. This lawsuit, if you can believe this, Frank, was filed back in 2011. And the Obama administration, under both Loretta Lynch and Eric Holder, the Justice Department, refused to get into the lawsuit and represent this Air Force officer. They refused to help him, even though the territorial government was straight out discriminating against him. They finally won it at the district court or trial level in Guam. The territory of Guam appealed the decision to the Ninth Circuit this year. And now, finally, after 8 years of ignoring the case, the U.S. Justice Department has come in on the side of Mr. Davis, the retired Air Force officer. Very clear that only happened because the Trump administration took over and said, well, we're going to do what's right in this case.
I'm delighted that Jeff Sessions' Justice Department is doing that. It's facing a lot of criticism on other fronts. And I guess I would just ask you, in particular, Hans von Spakovsky, how the Trump administration is doing on the issue of judges and sort of the Justice Department's performance more broadly.
Well, you know, they have probably nominated some of the best individuals to ever be nominated for the federal courts. And so far, he's gotten a fair number of them confirmed, even though the Democrats are forcing what are called cloture votes on every single one. That has never happened in the entire history of the United States. In other words, the Democrats are doing everything they can to delay these people getting in. But the choices they're making are very good. They're all conservative constitutionalists, people who believe in applying the Constitution and the law as written, not as some liberal judge would imagine they think it ought to be. So that they're very good. At the Justice Department, the problem there is the swamp, as we call it. There are still so many people there who were hired during the Obama administration. You know, there are holdovers. There are political people who were put into career slots. You know, that's not supposed to happen, but it did. And so they have, frankly, all this internal opposition that's making it hard for them to get things done.
Yeah, it is indeed. We have to leave it at that. Hans, I want to get you back on soon to talk about election fraud. It seems as though there is election fraud after all, at least when it impinges upon Democrats' election prospects. But that's for another day. Thank you so much for visiting with us at this point on these very important issues, Hans, and for the great work you do at the Heritage Foundation and also on the President's Commission on Election Reform. We'll talk with you again soon, my friend. In the meantime, stay well. Come back to us soon. Russ Dallin is next. We'll get the latest on Venezuela and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.